Welcome back, my dear listeners and friends from around the globe, wherever you are on the planet. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and this is the second program of 2014, our eighth year in action with this radio program, questioning, investigating, and proceeding to unravel the mysteries and the conspiracies. Today we're talking with Randall Carlson, a professional designer and builder, student of sacred geometry, and a longtime Freemason. Randall Carlson is uniquely qualified to interpret the hidden meaning of the greater masterpieces of mystical architecture. It is his aspiration to effect a revival of lost knowledge towards the goal of creating a new world based upon universal principles of harmony, freedom, and spiritual evolution. Randall emphasizes the cyclical nature of time and the periodic catastrophes responsible for the collective amnesia of our species. He returns today to discuss Sangreal, the Holy Grail, recovering the cosmic science of antiquity and the connection to cyclical catastrophe and the onset of ice ages and warming periods. But we'll begin to discuss comets and panspermia. Well, hey, Randall, welcome back. It's great to speak with you once again. Thank you for returning to Red Ice Radio and I guess continue our fascinating talks that we've had in the past. Good to have you back, Randall.
Oh, it's great to be back, Henrik.
You bet. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk more about today is the very interesting Sangreal, or the Holy Grail series that you guys have been doing over at Sacred Geometry International. It's been a focus of yours in the last couple of months, really, and it's a very interesting tie-in that you guys did with comets, Age of Catastrophe, and the doomsday premonition that it evokes in people. But I think one place we could begin to talk more about that, Randall, would be Ison. I mean, it was said to become potentially the comet of the century and everything, but again, it was drowned, I believe, in the sun, more or less. It turned out to be another whimper, like Elanine. Kind of disappointing, huh?
Very disappointing. You know, to somebody who's interested in the science of comets, you know, no comet is ever that disappointing, because we can always learn something from every single visitor from the cosmic deep. But in this case, you know, I was more like, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a spectacular comet to sort of remind everybody that there's a larger environment in which we all live? You know, something to, because, you know, there hasn't been a really good comet now since Hale-Bopp. And, you know, that's been a while. So there's a whole new generation of young people and that have never seen a spectacular comet. And I think it would have been wonderful if we'd had an event like that that could just inspire people to think about the higher realm that and how it may affect us, which it does quite frequently. But the fact is that it did, it disintegrated and turned into a stream of dust. And that in itself is rather interesting, because dust and boulders, I should add. And, you know, the part of, I think, what we've been trying to set out is this argument that, you know, oftentimes what's going on down here on the surface of this planet can be affected by things that we're not really so aware of, such as the accretion of cosmic dust into the atmosphere, or the entry of, you know, small bolides, as we saw last February, which was undoubtedly the remnant of some comet at some point, I believe.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that we'll be having some more on the way before too many years passes by. One of the things that seems to be the case is that comets kind of come in clusters. It seems like we go through episodes where it's cosmically quiet, and then those get interrupted by these short bursts of intense cosmic activity that really is the thing that's the game changer, the thing that really resets the ecological clock, so to speak. And it's these events that I think that we've tried to suggest are embedded in many of the ancient myths and traditions and legends of our ancestors, who experienced these episodes of discontinuous introduction of cosmic material into the biosphere.
Well, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting aspects of this. And one thing that I remember we followed on the website for quite a while was the red rain and everything. And I know that you guys wrote about that. We'll get to that a little bit later. But are you a believer in the Oort cloud and all that, that's like where it comes from? I've heard various people being highly critical of that. We even have the possibility that we've had remnant planets in our system, and this is one area where actually a lot of debris, you know, more or less comes from. But what's your stance on that, Randall?
Well, I'm not familiar with a lot of the criticisms of it. I mean, most of the what I think is solid science that I've looked at suggests that it is real. That, you know, the discoveries, the ongoing discoveries of extra solar bodies seems to confirm that there is a reservoir out there. You know, the exact configuration of the reservoir perhaps would require some adjustment. But, you know, both Jan Oort and Kuiper, who predicted the Kuiper disk, did so on very solid astrophysical grounds that these reservoirs of comets should be there. And what seems to be happening now is that the empirical data that's emerging from telescopic observations of those regions of space certainly seems to be confirming that these things do exist out there in considerable abundance. And also the trajectories of the long period comets, the parabolic orbits, the geometry of those orbits is consistent with an Oort cloud origin. Now, you know, I'm not going to hang my hat, you know, on that particular model and say that that's the final explanation.
Right. Yeah.
But I haven't really seen any data to contradict that. Now, you know, maybe somebody has presented some to you, but I'm not aware of it. So I'd be interested in seeing what, you know, what they're presenting in terms of hard scientific evidence that there's a different model that explains better the introduction of comets into the inner solar system.
Definitely. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about where we could begin looking at this, because there's a couple of different interesting theories about where where it comes from, basically, or even how origins of our own life on this planet occurred. We had the Swedish scientist, actually, Svante Arrhenius, who actually came up with this, he coined the term panspermia, and a little bit later, I think there was an evolution to that, which they called directed panspermia. Now, that's pretty interesting to me. I think that there's a lot to that particular theory, because if we look at the, you know, the Cambrian explosion, the onset of, you know, anaerobic bacteria on the planet, it literally looks like something has been introduced. Of course, some people have a very wide speculation on that it might actually literally have been introduced in that way. But panspermia, or directed panspermia, that could be what the origins of life is. Tell us more about that, Randall.
Well, I think, you know, as you just said, panspermia is the idea that the precursors of biological life were introduced into the into the terrasphere, if you want to call it that, via comets and asteroids. And we certainly know that these precursors exist in meteorites. They've been found and identified. The what are called the purine or purine bases that go to form the nucleotide bases or the nucleotides of the DNA molecule, adenine and thymine, have both been found in abundance in meteorites. For example, in the Murchison meteorite, they found these the components of the nucleotide components of the DNA molecule. So it's very interesting that these things are showing up in material that's being delivered into the Earth from the cosmos. And it certainly does support the idea that at least the precursors to biological life came from outer space. And that's been a theory that's, you know, like you mentioned, Arrhenius, and he's been around for quite a while, but it was picked up on by, Francis Crick, who's written a book, one of the discoverers of the DNA molecule, co-discoverers, actually wrote a book on the origins of life and concluded that, you know, life had a cosmic origin. And then there was Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe, who were probably the principal modern exponents of that idea that life was delivered to Earth from space. Now, it's one thing to talk about panspermia, the idea that it could be, that life somehow, or at least the precursors of life, has the capability of crossing the vastness of interstellar space and be delivered into a planetary matrix that could serve as a vessel, if you will, for the then the proliferation of that life. But when you talk about directed panspermia, I think you're getting to a much more controversial area.
Because
that opens up a whole Pandora's box of implications that I think mainstream science may now be willing to look and consider the idea that, because clearly we now have hard scientific evidence in hand that this is a distinct possibility. But then to suggest that, you know, something or someone is directing that is a whole different ball game altogether.
Oh, it sure is. Oh, definitely. Now, let's tie in the Holy Grail into this and kind of lead in it that way, and maybe there is a good tie-in or a passage basically from the symbol of the cup to comets and the vision that we've have of comet. The evoking thing that it produces, of course, is both this kind of looming and doomsday and everything else, like when we see comets in the sky kind of thing. But how do we tie that together with the Holy Grail, Randall?
Well, this has kind of been the subject of these articles I've been posting online. It's a complicated issue, but it essentially is, it's to me, it's implied in the texts themselves. If we go, for example, to Parzival by the German, the medieval German author Wolfram von Eschenbach, this is an example of a quote that would certainly suggest and point to the cosmic connection of the Grail. And this is, he's describing where the origin of the story was, and he attributes it to a one Kayat, who was the well-known master found in Toledo, discarded, set down in heathen writing, the first source of this adventure. A heathen, Flagitanus, had achieved high renown for his learning. This scholar of nature was descended from Solomon and born of a family which had long been Israelite until baptism became our shield against the fire of hell. He wrote the adventure of the Grail. And then it goes on to say that this particular one, Flagitanus, could tell us how all the stars set and rise again. To the circling course of the stars, man's affairs and destiny are linked. The heathen saw with his own eyes in the constellations things he was shy to talk about, hidden mysteries. He said there was a thing called the Grail, whose name he had clearly read in the constellations, and a host of angels left it on the earth. This is an example of some of the writings that clearly seem to suggest a cosmic origin for the Grail, whatever it may have been. We could go on. There was quite a few others. It's described. Let's see if I've got another one handy here. It's been described in so many diverse ways. For example, one of the modern Grail scholars, Roger Sherman Lewis, has written that no legend of the Middle Ages, except those endorsed by the church, has had so strong an evocative and provocative power as the strange fictions which grew up about the Grail. And he said, it is not strange that the medieval legends should have engendered in our century so diverse an offspring, for they are a bewildering assortment of battle and banquet, earthy magic and sacramental miracle, blood feuds and mysterious rites. It goes on, pretty much every scholar that has ever addressed themselves to the Grail has come away somewhat baffled by the complexity of it and the multifarious ways in which it has been described in the literature. And if you turn to the discussion of the Grail procession, which was described primarily in the work of Creton de Troyes in his work Percival, it's clear that it's very suggestive of a cosmic origin for the Grail. If you recall the procession, the whole sequence, the whole ritualized presentation of the Grail began with the presentation of the sword to Percival. He's there in the hall of the Fisher King, who has been maimed by what has been referred to in some of the later texts as the dolorous stroke, which implies that he was wounded in some tremendous event. According to one legend, it was in a battle. He was pierced through the thighs by the sword of Balor. In another story, he's actually pierced in the genitals. And in any case, he's left maimed. And then along with that is the decline or debilitation of the kingdom as well. And so the kingdom has declined into this status of a wasteland. Crops are dying in the fields. Babies are being stillborn. There's disease rampant, famine. All of these bad things have engulfed the kingdom at the same time the king himself becomes sick. Well, in the Grail mythos, the eventual secret that is, prized out of all of this symbolism is that the king and the land are one. And when the king is healed, when the king is maimed, the land falls into decay. When the king is healed, the land is rejuvenated.
He's like a personification of the land that he sees over, pretty much. Huh?
Exactly. He's somehow on some subtle energetic level linked with the landscape itself. But we can look at this as being a metaphor for this higher process, because we know, interestingly, that at the time that the Grail Quest would have been undergone, which was during the time of Arthur, King Arthur and the Camelot and the Round Table, can actually be placed historically to about the first third of the 6th century AD. And, the death of Arthur at the Battle of Camlann was generally placed at somewhere between 539 and 542 AD. And it was this quest for the Grail that was inspired by the need to restore the wasteland to fertility. And it was only through the acquisition of the Grail, the return of the Grail to the court of King Arthur, that the king could be replenished, or the Grail to the hall of the Fisher King, so that he could be replenished, that the land would be healed. So what's interesting, though, is that that very period that most Grail scholars would place the events surrounding King Arthur had something very interesting going on that could now be objectively verified. And this was the work of a number of dendrochronologists who were looking at tree rings as a proxy for environmental and climate change. And one in particular, Mike Bailey, realized that period, roughly for one decade, from about 536 to, say, 545 AD, something very dramatic happened in the climate that seems to be perhaps global in scale. And the signal of this shift in climate showed up in the tree rings, in that it appeared that forest growth for almost a decade came to almost a halt. And this would coincide with most likely a severe drop in temperature. And it's at the same time there are historical accounts that describe, the dimness of the sun for repeated seasons, the pall in the air, the dust, the fact that there was essentially no summer for several years in a row.
Yeah.
And we know that by 542, which were presumably, if these events were inaugurated between 536 and 540, and something came along that affected the fertility of the land and the climate, the weather, and there was a drop in temperature, which actually has been also objectively verified as some of the coldest years of the last 2,000 years occurred within that decade. So it's very likely that with the multi-year failure of crops, that people got weak, they were starving. Famine always opens the door to pestilence, because once people are malnourished, their immune systems become vulnerable to invading pathogens. Yep. And we have the onset of the Justinian Plague around 542 AD that wiped out at least a third the population of Europe. So we have this whole sequence of events, of dramatic events that occurred apparently, and the signal is now has been identified to have apparently been a global signal. But it would seem to be particularly severe in the area of Northwestern Europe. But it also showed up quite strongly in tree rings in North America as well. But it's interesting, see, that you have these series of events that occurred precisely during this era that has this concentrated a body of literature focused upon about this quest for this Grail, whose purpose is to restore, the fecundity and the fertility of the land.
Right.
So this to me is really suggestive. We've got the Grail literature that creates one scenario, that paints one picture, and now we've got hard scientific evidence confirming that, during precisely that episode of history, something was going on very unusual in the planetary environment. And of course, historically, that's pretty much where you know, historians of the last, you know, who look at that period have described being the onset of the Dark Ages. And so for the next 300 or 400 years, there was a period of decline in Western culture. And we saw, you know, saw the decline of European population. It didn't really rebound until the onset of the medieval warm period, about 900 AD. Which, so the question then becomes, you know, what was the trigger? What was the cause behind these environmental changes?
Yeah.
And then that's where I think that the whole, that the Grail literature may be pointing us in, you know, in the direction that we need to look at. And it also seems that there's additional evidence now that there actually was possibly even more than one encounter with cosmic material exactly during that period of time. And I can pull up my notes on that, but the Gulf of Carpentaria appears to have a crater form in it. And also there appears to be a crater now that's been called, named Grendel, off the coast of Norway, that seems to be dating right there from about 530 to 540 AD. So, you know, we're seeing these multiple lines of evidence that seem to be converging onto this scenario that perhaps between 536 and 540 AD, Earth experienced perhaps even several encounters, which to me could be most easily explained by Earth encountering the debris of the debris stream of a disintegrating comet. And it's not unlikely that if the Earth crosses a relatively dense debris swarm in the course of, you know, a period of several years, while that debris swarm is in the process of thinning out, that there could be multiple encounters, both with bolides that could be on the scale of a Tunguska size event, but also simply streams of dust that can increase the optical density of the atmosphere such that, you know, the temperature drops precipitously and literally can bring on a mini ice age.
Hmm. Wow. And the possibility that we have, again, then if panspermia is correct, then we have the possibility of bacterial, microbial life actually surviving in space, which is, you know, that's interesting in itself. But if we pass, if the Earth's path is through that field, if you will, debris field of the comet, as the sun hits it and that, you know, hits the temperature on it and that just makes these the water in the comet boil and explode pretty much outwardly, that means that we could go through that debris field, because there is this narrative in some of the literature as well that talks about, as you said, a plague is something that's associated with the stone that's, you know, streaks across the sky pretty much, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So that could be, what would that be, do you think? Would it be a weird mutation or something, basically, that it's so foreign to us that we're not accustomed to it here on this planet, so when it enters our, you know, our biosphere and it comes in the form of sickness to us, or how do we explain that?
Yeah, well, it appears that it could come in the form of viruses. And there's, you know, the work primarily, you know, again, Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe have done most of the work on this. And I think it was going back even to the early 80s that they published a book called Diseases from Space. Huh. And the work, you know, at that time, it was considered pretty fringe, I think, by the mainstream. But in the interim, there's been a lot of accumulating evidence that supports that idea that perhaps there are, you know, viral elements that are introduced into the biosphere from space that could have been responsible for causing plagues. You know, and it could be that there are things, and I think in some of their more recent work before Fred Hoyle passed, there's been evidence that would suggest that there's constantly viral material being introduced into the atmosphere from space, but doesn't necessarily have an effect in the sense of causing widespread disease. However, when you know, you have large swaths of the population who have, you know, who have been basically malnourished for several years and their immune systems get weakened, some of these viral components can then, you know, seize that opportunity to begin to spread because of weakened human immune systems.
Hmm. Wow. Fascinating. Now, the symbolism of the Grail is not single, of course. It's multi-layered. It could mean a potentiality of many, many different things. And what I found interesting as well is that it's seemed to have branched off in many different categories. I mean, you have the Arthurian kind of passage alone, which is specifically just kind of targeted the British, or at least, you know, northwestern Europe kind of area. But then there's more to it than that, because it's obviously a previous kind of mythology coming through, the Israelis and everything else there. But the fact is that it might be just the idea that it's a stone alone I've always found very interesting, and that this stone becomes later on a object of worship in some regard. And we have there's so many different stones showing up in the past. I mean, we obviously have the Kaaba, you know, alone, yeah. But there's Laia Fail, the Stone of Scone, the Coronation Stone. This is multiple of these different ones, right? So could that literally be a stone from outer space that they've people began worshipping?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that the consensus of opinion on it is the Kaaba is, in fact, a meteorite. And we certainly know that many indigenous groups around the world worshipped meteorites. American Indians were well known to have collected and held meteorites amongst their sacred objects. You know, there were implements made of meteoritic iron, ritual implements that were found in the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Yeah.
The list goes on and on. You know, Chinese counterparts of utilizing stones fallen from the heavens as sacred objects. And I think we're finding out, perhaps, and we'll continue to find out, that, you know, again, the ancients around the world were much more apprised of and interested in these things that fell from heaven, and, you know, oftentimes held them in high regard. You know, there were stories about Northwest Pacific Indians from the Northwest Pacific in the U.S. who worshipped meteorites. And in fact, there were several, I think, perhaps from memory, which serves me right, the Willamette meteorite that was, now I think it's on display in the Chicago Museum of Natural History, I believe, but it was found out in Oregon amongst a group of erratic boulders that had been delivered to a spot in the Willamette Valley by the waters of the great Missoula flood. And which is interesting, because these erratic boulders were from Canada, and the Willamette meteorite was found within this cluster of boulders, which suggests that it too was transported out of Canada. But given that the pristine nature of the meteorite itself would suggest that it had been transported aboard an iceberg, because the ablation hollows within the meteorite were very well preserved with very intricate edging and an ablation hollow is when the meteorite is coming through the atmosphere and you have pockets of material that melt out and then essentially sublimate right out of the meteor because of the great heat. And it leaves a sort of a pockmarked effect with very delicate ribbed edges and so on. And the surface condition of the Willamette meteorite is so pristine that it would be very difficult to imagine it had been transported within a glacier out of Canada. And the fact that it is found amongst boulders whose source was Canada suggests that it also was transported from Canada. But the fact of the status and condition of its surface would suggest that it had been transported aboard an iceberg, which is very interesting, because then that brings us to this idea of this great event that occurred, 13,000 years ago, that terminated the last world age, if you will, that almost certainly now appears to have been precipitated by the incursion of a comet or the debris of a disintegrating comet.
Huh. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so my point, while I digress there, was that when the Willamette meteorite was found in the late 19th century, it was also disclosed, I think, by some of the locals that knew of it around there, that the Indians venerated it and held it in very high regard, the local tribes around there. So it's another instance of, indigenous peoples having this recognition that things from out there had special properties.
And again, just to clarify that point, it seems to have very much is the cyclical nature to it. It's almost like clockwork if we look at it in the past, right?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the things that we've been trying to present on the Sacred Geometry website, is that if you look at this whole, you know, I wrote a whole elaborate article on this that was on Graham Hancock's website last December, about the great year, the tempo of global change somehow seeming to be tied into this 26,000 year cycle. And I believe there is a very nice graphic that Cameron has done that's up on the website that really dramatically demonstrates this cyclic or periodic tempo of global change.
Yeah, I'm looking at that one right now. It's really well done, and it gives the idea exactly that it's very closely related to, if we walk round the timeline like in a circle, you know, it's pretty interesting. So what is it's always interesting to kind of ask a little bit where we are now in comparison to that to that chart, because again, it seems to, if there are regular extinction events, you know, happening on the planet, you know, people are of course worried that we're up for another one. But the fact is, you know, as you clarify as well, these near Earth objects are, in some regards, they literally swoosh by the planet, and it's like after the fact that they've passed over that we realized, oh, that was a close call. You know, we don't have a full control of everything that goes out gone out there in space. Far from it.
No, and what we're learning is that, you know, near Earth space is far more densely populated than we even imagined, you know, a few decades or a generation or two ago. And, you know, there are simultaneous discoveries going on. You know, we're realizing that the Earth's surface has been profoundly affected by impacts from things from space. There's now about roughly 200 impact craters that have been identified worldwide, basically throughout the period since the Cambrian. A lot of those have been relatively recent. And we got to also realize that we're looking at almost all of these 200 are on the land surface. You can figure that if there's 200 plus, I mean, every year a new one is being found. So or multiple impact craters or astrobleems are being found. Now, the difference between an impact crater and an astrobleem is simply that a crater is the classic bowl or cup shaped that you would see. The most well-known example of that would be Meteor Crater in Arizona, which is, have you ever seen pictures of that, or have you been there by any chance?
I haven't been there, but yeah, I've seen pictures. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. But as the eons roll by, these craters will erode, they will become filled with sediment. So they're no longer really craters in the classical sense of a bowl shaped landform, but at that point we call them astrobleems, which means star wounds. And oftentimes these things can be discovered, just like the Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan, the 65 million year old impact crater is actually under nearly 2,500 feet of carbonaceous sediment. So it's not really even exposed at the surface. And that would be classified as an astrobleem. But, you know, the thing is that, I guess what I'm getting at is that, you know, because of the fact that the oceans are roughly 3/4 of the land surface, you know, we're looking at the known craters on the continents as being roughly 1/4 of the total number of craters. And of course, you know, we're still, you know, there's going to be, for example, some of the more recent crater discoveries have been under the Antarctic ice sheet, in the Brazilian rainforest. So there's undoubtedly going to be many dozens more identified on the land surface. And you got to figure, for every one impact on the land surface, there's got to be roughly 3 impacts into the ocean that's not going to leave a permanent remnant in the landscape, or at least one that would be immediately recognizable.
Yeah.
And an impact into an ocean could have just tremendous consequences for the biosphere. You know, and what seems to be emerging from the research of for the Holocene Working Group, for example, has been to identify what appears to be at least 3 impacts through the course of the Holocene that were into the ocean. One into the Indian Ocean and one into the Pacific Ocean that may have been very significant, you know, kilometer-sized objects that were able to penetrate, you know, in the case of the Indian Ocean, perhaps as much as 2 miles of ocean water and still leave a 12 to 18 mile wide diameter hole in the bottom of the Indian Ocean. Wow. Now, you know, that's been challenged, but at the same time, I think that the challenges I've read to it seem to be mostly coming from the position that, well, this, you know, doesn't really fit our models of the you know, the numbers of impacts that have happened in modern times. But to me, it seems to be what's emerging on multiple fronts is that impacts are much more frequent than anybody had suspected, you know, even a generation ago. I mean, much more frequent. And I would suspect strongly that the Holocene impact events are going to ultimately pan out and prove to be viable. And we're talking about some major events. You know, the one in the Indian Ocean apparently left chevron-shaped tsunami deposits on both coasts of Australia as well as Madagascar.
Yeah.
And on Madagascar, these tsunami deposits are 600 feet in thickness. And they show up very prominently on Google Earth. Anybody can Google southern Madagascar and quickly find these huge chevron-shaped deposits, which seem to suggest landfall of at least a 600-foot tsunami wave. And what's interesting there is that the chevrons essentially can be seen as indicators of the direction from which the wave arrived. And Dallas Abbott, I believe, and the Holocene Working Group are the ones who did most of this work on it. And we're able to identify what appears to be a large crater on the floor of the Indian Ocean in precisely the right place to have generated a tsunami wave outward from this epicenter. And it dates to, you know, not much over 5,000 years ago.
Wow.
And if you look at the configuration of the Indian Ocean, what's interesting is the tsunami wave would have moved north, and then as it entered into the Gulf of Arabia, it probably would have actually increased in height and pretty much washed up, tremendous wash up the Persian Gulf region. And this, I'm now thinking, is likely the origin of the Middle Eastern flood legends, you know, from Noah to Utnapishtim to Xisuthros and the others. And I'm not sure about whether the upcoming Noah movie gets into any of that or not. I just saw a couple of minutes of a preview.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think they do. It'll be interesting to see, though. You know, every time Hollywood comes out with a new variation on some of these themes, they usually get a little bit of it right, and then, you know, they take considerable license with the other details.
Oh, yeah. No, but it's interesting, though. It's yeah, I remember those the chevrons there in Madagascar and the way that massive event that must have been, and we're talking about things that change the topography, you know, in an instant. These are not some of the features that we see are not things that have taken, like, you know, hundreds and thousands of years to grind down or build up or something like that. It's like, they're so powerful. So what happened with, like, life during that time overall, though? I mean, that's when we get the extinctions. We could even get blocking out of the sun, right? We have the onset of possibly another, you know, ice age as a consequence of those, if it's big enough, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, you know, one of the difficulties is it's explaining the origin of an ice age, because, you know, you've got this weird conjunction of different events that somehow seem inconsistent with each other, because for one thing, you have what appears to be massive precipitation events, you know, which of course requires heat, you know, in order to have, whether it's rainfall or snowfall, in order to get that moisture into the atmosphere, you have to have heat. But then, of course, in the onset of an ice age, which seems to happen extremely quickly in the geological sense, in fact, some researchers, as you know, even back in the 70s and 80s, looking at the onset of the last global ice age, referred to it as instant glaciarization, because it seemed that the transition from interglacial into full glacial conditions was so quick that they couldn't even decipher any duration of or span of time within a geological record. It was interglacial, and then it was glacial. And it appears that, you know, you had large tracts or large swaths of land that were very rapidly covered with glacial ice, which then, of course, changed the balance of albedo, which caused further reduction in the temperature of the Earth and further expansion of the glaciers. So, and at this stage, we still don't really have an explanation for the onset of an ice age, and we don't have an explanation for the termination of an ice age. But most of the models that you look at either are purely terrestrial-based, or as far as they go in terms of extraterrestrial phenomena, it's basically the slowly changing relationship between the Earth and the Sun due to the obliquity of the ecliptic, the elliptical shape of the Earth's orbit, and so on, which slowly changes the delivery of solar heat to the surface of the Earth. The problem is with those, and they undoubtedly are a player within the whole scheme of things, is that these changing geometries work over very long periods of time. And the responses, the terrestrial responses to these extraterrestrial slow changes in the delivery of solar heat to the Earth, the terrestrial response is virtually instantaneous. And so it begs the question of what other forces are at work.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the question becomes, how do you simultaneously heat the atmosphere, or at least inject enough water vapor into the atmosphere to have a large rain out or precipitation event, whether it's rainfall in the form of rainfall or snowfall, and at the same time have it be cold enough that once that snow falls to the ground, it doesn't melt?
Yeah, exactly.
See,
yeah.
There's the problem, see? And I think that it's going to be in some configuration of a cosmic impact into a global ocean that you're able to inject the large amounts of material into the upper atmosphere that then precipitates out, but at the same time creates which would create a short-lived runaway greenhouse because of all the water vapor. But at the same time, once the water vapor dissipates, you're going to have particulate matter in the atmosphere that now would shroud the planet and prohibit or inhibit the amount of solar radiation that could actually reach the surface. So it seems to me that in some variation of a cosmic event like that is where we need to look for the most fruitful explanation for the onset of an ice age. Likewise, it seems that once an ice age gets inaugurated, there's a set of these feedback loops that would essentially perpetuate it forever. And that is that once the ice expands, you know, the amount of heat reflected by glacial ice, say from the land surface, is considerable. So once you have this expansion of glacial ice, a lot of heat is reflected back into space, which causes a further cooling, which should then cause a further expansion of the ice, which then causes a further cooling, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So what breaks that cycle? Well, again, I think the answer is ultimately going to lie when we begin to look to exogenic sources, that is, sources outside. You know, it's in a way, it's a rephrasing of Newton's second law. You know, a system is going to remain at rest or in motion unless acted upon by an outside source.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what we're actually seeing here, is that the global environment is going to remain relatively steady state until it is acted upon by an outside source. And the most effective outside source, in my opinion, has got to be incursions of cosmic material, whether it's in the form of asteroids, comets, cosmic dust, as being the preeminent ones, possibly others as well. You know, supernovas and nearby exploding stars have been proposed. I think that could be an effect that has an influence on a much larger scale. But rather than having a direct effect, I tend to think that those kind of events that are more like on a galactic scale have an indirect effect, in that what they do is they jostle the cometary reservoir. And once they do that, then they send comets cascading towards the sun at intervals that would suggest, again, this periodicity. These cascading comets falling towards the sun then begin to break up. They litter the inner solar system with the byproducts of their disintegration, and then Earth encountering those byproducts goes through a whole series of changes, whether it's, you know, the transition into an ice age, the transition out of an ice age, or on a lesser scale, what would be called a transition from a stadial to an interstadial. Because what you have is you have degrees. So you have a full-blown ice age, which would have been, you know, the, what the planet was locked into for roughly 12,000 years, you know, from about 13,000 years ago to about 25,000 years ago, what is called the late Wisconsin, or the final phase of the Wisconsin ice age, lasted about 12 or 13,000 years. And the planet was locked into that. And then somewhere between 11 and 13,000 years ago, a series of events more or less jerked the planet out of that ice age. So now we went from a full-blown ice age into a full-blown interglacial age. And in between those two extremes, you have what are called stadials and interstadials. So that in an interglacial period like we are in now, there can be fluctuations. So we go from, you know, the Roman warm period into the cold of the Dark Ages, into the medieval warm period, followed by the Little Ice Age.
Right.
And now we're back into a relatively warm period again. Likewise, during a glacial episode, during an ice age, you have oscillations like that as well. So you'll have periods where the glaciers will contract fairly significantly, but they don't disappear. You know, the ice sheets, they'll shrink, but they don't disappear. That's a stadial or an interstadial. Then a stadial is when they grow back more or less to their full size. And so the within the ice age itself, there are these oscillations. And those are what are referred to as the stadials and interstadials. And to me, to my mind, those could probably be, and again, explained by lesser incursions. The thing that happened around 13,000 years ago was very severe. If we look at the reaction of the biosphere to this event, and we look at the chain of life, if we look at the food chain, what we see essentially is that the food chain, between 11 and 13,000 years ago, was essentially decapitated. We had a mass extinction of species that was roughly half the megafauna on the planet. That was, when I say megafauna, I'm talking about animals that weigh roughly 100 pounds or about 44 kilograms in body weight. Mm-hmm. And when you go back to the late Pleistocene, which ended with the Ice Age 12 to 13,000 years ago, the number of species of megafauna on the Earth was almost double what it now is.
Yeah.
And the event that brought the planet out of the Ice Age is intimately connected with this demise of species, which, you know, the prevailing orthodoxy about the demise of species is that, or at least in the case of the woolly mammoths, is that they were hunted to extinction by Paleo-Indian hunters. And that somehow perhaps the imbalances introduced into the ecosystem by the loss of the woolly mammoths somehow precipitated this, you know, domino effect that caused the extinction of, you know, some 120 other species of megafauna. Personally, the more I learn about the events associated with that mass extinction episode, the more I learn about the life ways of these the ancient peoples who are being blamed for this, the more I learn about the climate changes that were concomitant with these events, the less I'm inclined to think that there is any veracity whatsoever to this idea that humans were responsible for the mass extinction event. My take on it would be that humans probably also went near, you know, suffered dramatic losses, as did the woolly mammoths and other species. Now, that wouldn't necessarily show up in the gene pool if the groups of survivors were diverse enough around the planet, which is likely that they were. It would only take a couple of centuries to repopulate, you know, even if you had a mass extinction or a mass mortality event that could, I mean, for example, look at what happened with the buffalo in America and how quickly, if left to them, to their own devices. I mean, now they're almost a domesticated animal. We herd them and we breed them, we eat them,
right,
and so forth. But if we were to just let them go again, you know, within another 20 or 30 years, there could be literally millions of them roaming the plains.
Sure, sure.
So looking back, you know, a couple of millennium from now, one could completely miss the fact that the species almost went extinct.
Yeah.
You see, and it's likely that the animals, the species that didn't go extinct also suffered severe mortality, but were able to recover because there was enough species left enough individuals left to establish the viability of the species. And so they quickly rebounded once conditions were conducive to that. And my suspicion would be that human beings as well, because the evidence seems to suggest clearly that the Clovis culture that inhabited North America prior to these events collapsed at the same time. So, you know, this idea that, and you know, when we begin to learn more about the life habits of these peoples, it becomes apparent that, you know, they lived in small nomadic groups. They had a very diversified diet. They ate lots of small game. They foraged. A lot of them lived along the shores of the ocean and were eating shellfish and aquatic life. They fished. And you got to go, okay, if they had this diverse diet, why would they focus on, you know, hunting, which were undoubtedly one of the most dangerous creatures, you know, within their environment, to such a severity that the whole species becomes extinct? We're talking about, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 million individual species, which is interesting, because if you look at the estimated human population, it's actually less than the population of woolly mammoths. So how in the world, you know, it just, to me, it strikes me as being almost laughably ridiculous to say that these nomadic bands of Paleo-Indian hunters were somehow able to exterminate not only the woolly mammoths, but 120 approximately other species of large mammal. You know, I mean, who today in either Africa or India hunts elephants?
Yeah, very, very few, except the poachers, you know.
Well, the poachers do, yes, using automatic weapons.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And we're not going to assume that the Clovis people were using machine guns. but you know who actually hunts elephants using primitive weapons? There's one group of people in Africa, the pygmies.
Right.
The pygmies. And you know how they do it? They have a very sharp spear. I've forgotten what they tip their spears with, but apparently they're small enough that what they do is they run under the belly of the elephant and stab upwards.
Yeah.
And then they just wait until the elephant bleeds out, and then they finish him off. But other than that, you don't find people hunting elephants.
No.
And I don't imagine taking down a woolly mammoth would be an easy task. And you go, you know, when small game was abundant, when fish was abundant, when seafood was abundant, when there was plant foraging abundant, why would you focus on, you know, there was a Russian paleontologist a number of years ago, I remember, that did an estimate of how much mammoth meat the Paleo-Indian hunters had to be eating. And it was something on the order of 6 pounds of meat per day.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, geez, these guys must have been robust. You know, maybe if they were 9 feet tall, perhaps. But, you know, it just has never made sense to me. Then when you put on top of it that, yes, there are now well-documented climate changes that to all appearances would seem to be catastrophic in nature, that occurred exactly at the time that the population of these species collapsed, you know, why are we going to try to explain it by this, you know, ridiculous theory that roaming bands, small roving bands of hunters were able to somehow wipe out, you know, the woolly mammoths from, you know, from northwestern Europe all the way across Siberia, across the Bering Land Bridge into Alaska, down into, unglaciated North America, into Mexico, in fact, all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, and do all that within a millennium.
Right, right.
I don't think so, personally.
No, there's definitely more to it, to that story, than that. I've always found it very, very fascinating, too, with the Clovis people. By the way, I think Dennis Stanford over at Smithsonian had done some works on that. Pretty interesting. We're going to try to get him on as well. But before we proceed, Randall, or rather before we, take a break and then proceed, because I wanted to ask you more about Ganang Padung, if I pronounce that correct. There's more on the Grail symbolism and the red rain I want to get into as well. But why don't we talk a little bit about some of the stuff that you guys have over at Sacred Geometry International. I wanted to see if you wanted to talk anything about the classes that you guys have, and if there's anything people can do to kind of support your efforts as well, Randall.
Well, yes, we actually launched a series of online classes. We've done Level one. I'm working up some bonus material for the level one right now that I hope to get out to people before the year's end. But it essentially was about 8 lessons, and it's, they're video clips that you can download in PDF files. basically start people at the, you know, at the very fundamental, rudimentary level. And I, essentially, the idea is to teach them how to do geometric drawing in the classical sense using a straight edge and a compass and going through a whole series of exercises and learning how to actually develop these patterns and these forms and to make it a usable tool that, that you know, builders, architects, designers, craftspeople, anybody who's in some kind of creative enterprise can use as a tool to enhance their creativity. And then my intention is, as we develop the higher levels of these classes, is to get into the thing that I think really makes sacred geometry sacred, to differentiate it from regular Euclidean textbook geometry, is the fact that there's a symbolical component to it. And so once you've gone and you've mastered the forms and the patterns and you see how, you know, how you generate a square out of a rectangle and how you can create a series of dynamic patterns out of simple forms, there are analogs within these processes of geometric construction that I think are parallel processes of cosmic creation, if you will. Getting back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, you know, we have the whole, you know, configuration of the DNA molecule, which is based upon the two helical sugar phosphate backbone strands linked together by these purine and pyrimidine bases. And the whole thing, when you begin to look at it, it's purely geometric. And it's essentially a fourfold cross. It's a pentagonal sugar molecule. It's a fourfold phosphate molecule that's in the shape of a cross linked with a pentagonal sugar molecule. And these in turn are linked with these bases, which again are in the form of pentagons and hexagons, and it's due to the geometry of each of these molecules that the two helical strands link together as they do. So the where I finished level one is with the final lesson that I'm about to send out, essentially takes what we have learned through these drawing exercises and looks at it symbolically and shows how the processes are mimicked in the formation of organic life, organic molecules, which utilize these geometries that we have been exploring through these drawing exercises. Also looking and using the templates and the patterns that emerge from these exercises to analyze works of art, works of architecture, growing things of all kind, galactic structure, the structure of the solar system and disposition of the planets, et cetera, the astronomical realm. So, you know, sacred geometry is the idea that geometry pervades everything throughout creation. And that by working through this process of these, performing these exercises, you sort of inculcate this awareness into your consciousness. And the idea here too is that our consciousness can actually organize itself around these patterns of harmony that we explore through these geometric drawing exercises. And thereby, you know, it affects our consciousness in such a way that we begin to become more receptive to the harmony, the patterns of harmony that pervade the world around us, because they're there everywhere. And I think that the evidence would suggest that at various times throughout history, various cultures have consciously attempted to integrate that into their societies so that the infrastructure of their society was reflective of these patterns of harmony that they had discerned not only in nature, but also through just the pure objective geometric exercises that they were performing through these schools. And I'm talking here about, you know, the Platonic schools and Neoplatonic and the Pythagorean Academy and others where geometry was taught as being a symbolical system. So I'm trying to resurrect that approach to geometry and put it out there as a tool and say, here, it's a tool of, you know, deeper philosophical and spiritual understanding of how the world works, but it's also a tool that can be employed by anyone who's involved in the creative process. You know, particularly, you know, since my background is in design and building, I kind of put that emphasis on it, that if you are any kind of a person who's, you know, if you're involved in design in any way, you know, if you're an architect, an interior designer, a builder, or but it goes far beyond that. I mean, if you're even if you're an artist, you know, the thing is that we can look at great works of art. We can see that if we were to essentially remove the forms of the artistic composition, there's a geometric template.
Certainly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we've mentioned that before, and I just want to emphasize that point as well, that if you're in that field, you know, whether it's imagery or architecture, any kind of design, really, I mean, that should be people's responsibility at that stage to take those components into it. I think even for their own sake as well, of course, because that helps people to, I think, enjoy whatever they produce, because there's nothing like a, you know, a fine, balanced, you know, image or something that's designed. That's key, you know?
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, that's, I would like to see it become much more widespread. I think, you know, that our environment, our built environment, could benefit immensely by, you know, having architects and builders and designers understand that, you know, that there are these objective principles of harmony, and they seem to be intrinsic, particularly to life, organic processes, biological processes. And, that it would be to the betterment of our world and our society to begin to incorporate some of these things into the environment around us, so that whether it's conscious or unconscious, the environment around us begins to reflect harmonious states of mind, and remind us that you know, that there is a harmony that pervades the cosmos, without which none of this order, this amazing order that we see all about us, from the atomic through the molecular up through the human and organic level up to the cosmic level, that without it, this order wouldn't exist.
That's right. Absolutely. That's definitely right. And I wanted to mention there as well, then, that people can find out more about that by going to circuitgeometryinternational.com, and you have the Learn Sacred Geometry banner right there on the right-hand side. And you guys still have the DVD there available as well, Cosmic Patterns and Cycles of Catastrophe. So that's some of the ways that people can, you know, get involved as well, beyond just following the website, of course. But
right.
Yeah, I think we should take a short break there, Randall, unless you have anything to add to that, and then we can pick up after the break.
No, other than that the subject matter that we began this discussion with, involving the Grail, there are a series of about 10 articles now online.
Yes, that's right. Yes,
that are accessible to anybody who wants to read them, and it goes into considerable depth and background and elaboration on these themes that we're talking about, with a lot of quotes and stuff from the Grail literature and a lot of cool imagery.
Oh, definitely. Sangreal, the Holy Grail, Recovering the Lost Science of Antiquity. We're going to have these links up as well on redicecreations.com. Okay, we'll take a short break here, guys. Yeah, go ahead, Randall, before we...
No, that's it. Sounds good to me.
All right. Okay, we'll be right back. More with Randall Carlson is coming up. As we proceed in the second hour, we talk more about Grail symbolism and the mysterious red rain over Karal in India. We talk about the plagues of Egypt as environmental catastrophic events. We discuss alchemical art and the carbon madness around global warming. And we look at this recent hysteria from a bigger, long-term climactic perspective. We also briefly touch upon free market environmentalism and other options that exists outside of the old political paradigm that simply tries to sell us the same old story in order to gain more control over our lives. Tune in at redicemembers.com, sign up for a membership, and stream or download any of our previous programs. Get full access to our immense and growing archive of radio programs, films, videos, and much more. We have RSS feeds, you can comment on our program as a member, and all of this comes to you without commercial interruptions and an ad-free website. Some of our upcoming guests include Sterling Allen, James Hall, David Talbot, Walter Block, and Richard Dewhurst. Well, in the meantime, we say thank you so much for listening to our first hour. I hope you join us in the second as we continue to speak more with Randall Carlson. We'll be right back after the break.